Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the chairman of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We also welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It is my distinct pleasure today to introduce our speaker, who is a surprise. Denise Schickel, who was expecting to give the lecture tonight, had an unavoidable conflict at the last minute and was not able to make it. Who do you think the surprise speaker is? Who's heard yes. How many have heard me before at the Monday Night Philosophy? So I am on short notice, the speaker on Nietzsche. Fortunately, I really like Nietzsche.
No, I'm an authority on Nietzsche. I don't know if that's going to interfere with your speech.
No, it won't interfere with my speech. I can talk to authorities, no problem. But that's why I asked beforehand about Nietzsche, about the people who you know really know Nietzsche well. If I do make any serious errors, I'm going to try to discuss the ideas and so on, and I do know these things, but I am far from, this is not my main area. I have about 100 main areas, but this isn't even one of those. So if I do make an error, you know, please chip right in and say, no, that's not really the way they look at it. We'll make this a discussion. We always try to make this a discussion anyway, but you can make it a discussion right in the middle of, you know, what I'm talking, no problem at all. Okay? So what I'd like to start with is something that I think is pretty funny. Because it's a good example of his irony and irony about philosophers. And I'm going to focus a little bit on let me say a little bit about Denise's topic and the way that it was described. She was very interested in the way Nietzsche and Abraham Maslow's ideas coordinated, disagreed with each other, and so on. And I'm going to try sometime in the future when we have an opening in the thing, to get her to come back and speak on those topics. I'm not going to try to go into that specialty of hers, because I want her to be able to give that speech later. So, but the general topic of Nietzsche, I'm going to concentrate more on Beyond Good and Evil, and especially on the section where he took down all the other philosophers, which I find very entertaining, and a very interesting take on a lot of different things. And this quotation is from the preface to that book. Maybe I should give a little background on Nietzsche first. People are aware of the date range. He was born in 1844 and died in 1900. Most of his work was done, most of the work that we know about, that's read and everything, was done in the 1880s, some in the 1870s. He did work earlier. He actually was one of the youngest full professors, I think full professor, of classical philology in the German universities. Were very tough on this. He was only 24 years old when he was made full professor. He hadn't even finished his PhD thesis yet, and I think even today that's still not maybe a record, but certainly among the youngest anybody's ever made a full professor. Obviously considered very intelligent by his peers, and at the time he was a philologist, and that informs his work quite a bit. He studied the languages. One of his claims, for example, in Beyond Good and Evil, is that there's a reason why there's a similarity between Vedic philosophy and ancient Greek philosophy and German philosophy, and that's because it was all based on the same language group. And he thought that the language group and the grammar had an effect on people in the way that they thought, and that would actually have an effect on the philosophy that they would come up with. But, you know, but there's a whole range, of course, of philosophy within each of those groups, and so it's an interesting idea, but you'll find a lot of those little touches of how he started his career in his work, which is quite an interesting aside. Very interesting way to take it. And he also thought of himself as more scientifically oriented than a lot of other people. And I think it's important to put him in the context of this was really an exciting time to be a philologist, you know, to study languages, because they figured out how to trace back the roots of languages and find this thing. Now, I think that had been done. Is anybody a philologist here? I think that had been done maybe 30, 40 years before he was born, the first, you know, big conquest of saying that Sanskrit and Greek were actually related to each other, and a lot of that work was done in Germany. And so what we take for granted, anybody who studied languages and everyone says there's this group and there's this group, that was fairly unknown. It was clear, of course, that French and Spanish and Italian were all related to Latin, because that had just happened, more or less, relatively speaking, only a few hundred years earlier. So that was clear, but that there was any relationship between Sanskrit and Greek and Sanskrit and German English, and that German and English were exactly more or less the same language that split off. Those kind of things were fairly unknown until the late 1800s, I think. late 1700s. So he was in the milieu of a very exciting time. I mean, if you think of all the exciting science that was done in the 20th century and people figure out something new, move forward, it's really exciting to find a new pattern in something. So in language, that was like that at the time. The other big idea that influenced them a lot, I think, you know, being in the culture, was Darwin's ideas. Darwin was saying, you know, we're really not what we thought we were. We're really just ascending. I think it's really important to understand his idea about where mankind was going and also how that idea was misused based on the idea that Darwin was saying that man has evolved out of all these other species. And so one of the ideas that I think that other people have used in the 20th century to great misuse or use, whatever you say, because it's hard to tell exactly where Nietzsche would come down on it, and I'll read something about that. But clearly he was thinking in terms of we have to develop our species. We have to make our species, we have to preserve our species, and we have to even cultivate our species, bring it to a higher level. Now, of course, that's a program for you know, creating difficulties in society if you're saying, you know, that you have to do it, and you don't sit back and say, well, evolution will take care of it slowly over the next 10 million years. No, people will take it and say, no, it has to be done right now, and we're going to do the work to make sure that the species improves. And, of course, you do all kinds of things that people afterwards are rightfully angry at you for. So that's a little bit of the background of what he did. He switched to philosophy at a certain point. He was a big fan and a familiar of Richard Wagner for a while, and then he kind of got in a fight with him later on because he disagreed with some of the things. And he, one of the ironies, because a lot of people think that Nietzsche was a forerunner of Nazism in Germany and so on, is that he was very upset about anti-Semitism. He thought it was a stupid idea. And he had a brother-in-law who was a really big fan of it, and maybe part of his emotional anger at it was because he didn't really like his brother-in-law very much. But in any case, there's a big strain in his ideas against anti-Semitism. But of course, as anyone who has studied the history of philosophy and seen how different ideas are used, you know, minor discrepancies like that can be papered over real easily by anybody, and they use the parts that they want. So that's a little bit of background. Would anybody like to add to that background a little bit about him? Okay.
Oh, he went insane.
Yeah. Okay, that's another very important thing. He went insane. He died in 2000. He sort of went insane in the year 1889. He was taken care of by his family, who had been at odds with him for a long time, basically because he went against Christianity. And they took care of him when he was insane. This is something for all philosophers to watch out for, because, you know, people who don't like you are very happy to take care of you when you're incompetent. This is and are very happy to say, oh, he's incompetent now, he was incompetent earlier. But the important thing, I think, there's a lot of discussion about his insanity, and a lot of people wish to believe that it was his ideas that drove him crazy. But I have to say, along a lot of lines like this, people like to put great philosophers or great thinkers or unusual thinkers, up on a pedestal. They like to put, you know, movie stars up on a pedestal. They like to deify all kinds of people, and then they like to show their clay feet and pull them back down again, because that gives us all a reason why we don't have to be like that, you know. Well, he that's right. One of the outgrowths of his work is existentialism. That's right. I don't think you can call him exactly an existentialist, but certainly the reaction to his work was important in existentialism and in nihilism too.
How old was he when he went clinically insane, and could he work from that point, or was his work?
He didn't. I don't think he created almost anything. I did a little bit of writing, but I don't think anybody can disagree. I think almost all of his major works were done before. Yeah. Okay. 1889. He was born in 1844, so he was 45 years old, and he died when he was 56 years old or so. Yeah.
The way I understand it, he was quite ill for a long time.
Right.
He only was healthy about 50 days out of the year, healthy enough to write.
Right.
And so he was basically bedridden, kind of transported around to try to stay healthy from climate to climate.
Right.
And then he was able to come out of his sickness and write one day a week.
Right. Yeah, so he was still, you know, somewhat active, but he had also had problematic, you know, problems with his health for his whole life, since his early 20s. A lot of people, as I said, think that his ideas, you know, how could you have those ideas without going insane? But not too many people really accept that idea. That's just a kind of a popular idea for how to make fun of somebody and make sure that you don't, you know, follow in his footsteps. You know, people have after the fact diagnoses, there's been a lot of them. I don't think that anybody has come up with a conclusion about it. Is there anything that's really, some people say that he had syphilis. Some people say that he had, you know, a different disease. Some people said it was, you know, a neurological thing. people really don't know. People don't know. So,
rheumatism.
Yeah, that's another thing. Yeah. Goes together.
Several things.
Yeah. Several things that are indicative, some things that are counterindicative against it, and so people haven't decided. But, you know, if you think that he deserved it because he had syphilis, that he should go insane, then people kind of push that idea. But most people don't really push too much as to what it was that he had.
But you might mention the role of his sister in leading to attempting to restore him and popularize him, but in fact you destroyed him.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Absolutely. His sister Elizabeth, who I think was the one that was married to the brother-in-law, which he didn't like, and that brother-in-law led a movement, an anti-Semitic movement that he found really idiotic, and they also tried to set up a new Germany in Paraguay. And this was in the 1870s and 80s. He died out there, and she came back to Germany very shortly before he lost his sanity. So that's about right? Yeah, and this sister, Elizabeth, had been fighting with him all along because, of course, he was against her ideas and stuff like that. One of the ironies is that Paraguay ended up being a place where a bunch of Germans went after World War II. So some of that actually took place. But in any case, Elizabeth had been fighting with him all along, and then some of his friends, you know, got a whole bunch of letters from him from Turin, Italy, which didn't make any sense at all. And so they realized that something was wrong. They went down to Turin and got him. That was in 1889. And they were taking care of him, and then the sisters started to get into the process, and they were editing his things, and, you know, eventually, because she would be the heir under the law, I don't know what the legal element of it was, but because she would be the heir to his work under the law, she got to control it. And because she didn't like certain things, especially some of the things against Christianity, she kind of took out some of them. But, you know, she wasn't clever enough. I guess they brought some teachers in to try to teach her a little bit about philosophy so she could do it, and they gave all of them gave up. So fortunately, she wasn't clever enough to know everything she should take out. And so a lot of stuff got out, and then I guess most of the original stuff eventually got restored after she lost control. Is that about right? But she did get in his way and his reputation way. Now, another thing, for all those who are authors that don't sell a lot of books, you should be happy about, you know, some of his very famous books only sold 40 or 50 copies for the first 10 years that they were available. And it wasn't for a long time before people started paying close attention. One of the reasons was he had a lot of influential friends in academia in Germany because he had been this really bright young professor, and they had all. But he went against a lot of their ideas, and so they didn't really like him. They were politely snubbed him, more or less, and sometimes not so politely. And some of his anger about this is apparent in his writing at times, and at other times he is admonishing others, but clearly himself saying, you can't take all of that criticism seriously. A great man doesn't take that criticism seriously. And you can read the subtext, I am a great man, therefore I shouldn't be taking this so seriously. And a lot of the time he didn't, but obviously it also grated on him that what he thought was really valuable, he couldn't get out into the marketplace. Not that there's a huge marketplace for something like Beyond Good and Evil today either, if it wasn't known by an unknown person. So... Any other big pieces or big chunks of his life that we should cover? Okay. This is on Plato in the preface to Beyond Good and Evil, which I think is very interesting and kind of tells a little bit about how he thought about things and really about the crucial idea. What does he mean by Beyond Good and Evil? Nowadays, when people hear the title Beyond Good and Evil and have these preconceived ideas about who Nietzsche was and everything, then they're saying, well, Beyond Good and Evil means that you just get to be evil. And that's not at all his conception, but the reason that people have that idea is because he's gotten connected with the Nazis, and therefore they all went beyond good and evil, and therefore that must be what he was talking about in Beyond Good and Evil, and that's not at all the concept at all. So this is what he says about Plato and Socrates, and very few people make these kind of astute observations. Indeed, as one physician might ask, how could the most beautiful growth of antiquity, Plato, contract such a disease? And the disease is to believe in the good, the beautiful. Did the wicked Socrates corrupt him after all? Could Socrates have been the corrupter of youth after all? And did he deserve his hemlock? And his argument there is like really turns the whole thing on his head. Basically, what he's saying is that, you know, Socrates obviously had to drink the hemlock because he was corrupting the youth by telling them that their gods didn't exist, that the Homerian gods didn't exist. That's not really what Socrates was spending his time doing either, but he was asking questions in a way that made it harder to believe in those things. But even so, that wasn't what he was after either. Because Nietzsche liked Plato so much and admired his nobility, he thought that this idea about the good, which he disagreed with completely, must have been a corruption that somebody else must have gotten into somebody that he really loved. How could he have believed in the good? Very interesting observation. And, you know, very rarely does anybody take on the idea of the good and perfection and say that is what is causing the problems. And I find that perfectly interesting because that's one of the ideas I worked with. How do you take that idea out of the picture and then come up with something else? But I won't talk about that. I'll talk about Nietzsche. So that's one really interesting observation. Obviously, he liked Socrates at times. He didn't like because basically he was in some ways a follower of Heraclitus, which was a more ancient Greek philosopher than Socrates, who believed in flux, that everything was in flux all the time, that there is nothing, permanent, and therefore, what are we going to do about this? Let's get rid of our childish illusions. And most of the time, Nietzsche sort of followed that idea. So one of the other things that I thought was really useful, and I was never, one of the ideas that I also got rid of in my early 20s, and that's a really important part of ancient Greek philosophy, is the opposites, that everything is an opposite. It's the tension between opposites that makes things happen. And that's also an ancient Vedic idea as well in ancient India. And he said that the belief in these opposites is a delusion. Now, one of the outcomes of that is when he discusses free will versus unfree will, he talks about it in a way which a lot of people don't discuss, and I think it's a really important thing to understand in his discussion. Instead of talking about free will and determinism, he talks about free will, unfree will, at least in the translation by Kaufman. But he says, no, that's not the way to look at it. Nobody has a totally free will. Nobody has a totally unfree will. There are degrees of willfulness. And what we really need to look at is who's got strong will, who's got a weak will. And his, you know, one of his big ideas is the will to power, that this is what underlies life. An irony about his idea about the will to power is that in a lot of places when he takes down the other philosophers, he basically says, all the different drives which we have in life, each has a main philosopher at almost all times saying, this is the real thing. This is the real drive. He said, it's a competition between those drives. And his drive, I mean, in a way, his drive is the will to power. That's what it is that he thought was at the basis of everything. But again, it is another example of exactly the same part of his theory, which is that each of these base drives, basic drives that we have, I don't mean base in a pejorative sense, each of these basic drives will have somebody that says, this is the main act, this is the main thing. So he said at the time, of course, there was a lot of idea that the drive to reproduce and to keep the species going was the main drive. But he said that's not it. The will to power, this preservation of yourself, preservation of the race, is an outcome of our will to power. And our will to power is just the pleasure, essentially, of exercising your will on the world. Of course, that also leads to interesting outcomes as well. But I think it's really interesting to take this idea of opposites and look at it from, you know, a little bit back and say, what are the opposites that everybody talks about? So in a way, beyond good and evil is to say, let's not talk about good and evil as opposites anymore. That's not a really good way to look at them. So that's where part of the concept. He's got, you know, it's Nietzsche. He has a multiplicity of meanings, a multiplicity of approaches to things. But one of the big ideas behind the idea of beyond good and evil is that we should get past this point of view of that these things are opposites. I'll give you an example of an idea that is going to probably go down in the next century, if I would say. you know, that this is a set of opposites that will not last, and that's mass and energy. Mass and energy are convertible into each other. And you can take mass and turn it into energy through Einstein's formula. That's the idea. But that's probably because they are the same thing in different states. That's usually what it is. If you take water and ice, you can say that they're opposites, but they're not opposites. They are the same thing, H2O, at different internal degrees of motion. And below a certain amount of motion, it turns into ice. Certain more motion, it's water. More motion, it's water vapor. And I think that that's a very good analogy, hot and cold. You know, if you look at it and you say hot and cold, those are opposites, right? Just like good and evil, hot and cold are opposites. But hot and cold are based upon your perception. If you are standing there, and, you know, a nice experiment that people give out is you take cold water and put a bowl of cold water and a bowl of hot water, and you're supposed to put your hands in both of them. And then you take your hands out and you switch them or something like that, and you're going to have a totally different experience with the two hands of what the other temperatures are like, because you've already accustomed to that. It's your sensory perception. I mean, there is something objective and there's something subjective. What's objective is the internal motion of the water. That's where the heat cold is. There's an internal motion. But you're at a certain amount of internal motion. We're at 98.6 degrees, right? And so what's 120 degrees is going to feel hot to us. And 150 or so, it gets to be scalding. It starts to really hurt. And 210, obviously boiling, is going to be really painful. And if you go down and it's 0 degrees, you know, those of you who have ever experienced a Wisconsin or a Canadian winter, you know, it's 30 below, you know, your nostrils freeze. You know, that's a totally different experience than what we consider cold in San Francisco. You know, a nice cold summer day, you know, but you're not getting freezing stuff through your nose as you do in this 30 below temperature. So it's a function, a relative function, what's hot and cold. But now, if we were not 98.6 degrees, but our bodies lived like some animals live in very hot, you know, like on the thermal, some algae live, you know, at 150 degrees right alongside the volcanoes under the ocean, stuff like that. That's their internal body temperature. That's what they're used to. So if it goes down to 120, that's cold. That's just like us from 80 to 50. You know, and so there is something real, something objective, and then there's something subjective. And it depends upon where you stand as to what looks like hot and what looks like cold. And I don't think Nietzsche, haven't read this, but that's the way I look at good and evil. And I think he had some of the same idea. Where you stand is where you decide what's good and what's evil. You look ahead. And he also had a totally different way of defining what's good and evil, because what was his base idea? The will to power. And so his idea about what's good and what's not so good had a lot to do with not Christian morality. You know, that's not the goal. The goal was, how much power can you exert as an individual on the world? How much can you create? How much can you change? And that's what's good. You know, a lot more of a pagan idea about what virtue is, what strength is. So that's another element of his idea. One of the things that he thought was a very dangerous idea was that untruth is actually part of life. Now, at this point in you know, 150 years later, people are not really thinking that's such a dangerous idea. People realize that, you know, I mean, people are very fond of untruth. If you take a problem like, you know, we have a bad reputation in the Middle East because of the war in Iraq, let's send a PR person there and change the perception of us. Okay? People don't talk about changing what we do. They talk about changing the perception based on PR, because everybody knows that you can push PR far enough to change the perception of people. And that's and clearly an untruth. Everybody lives with that. Everybody is at the basis. What I think isn't focused on is that it's a lot easier to change your behavior and change the perception than it is to keep trying to mask the behavior. But it's very clear that perception, what we perceive based upon our own belief system, is what we make our decisions on. We don't make it based upon some abstract, concrete, objective truth, or we'd all have the same opinions all the time, which is quite clearly untrue. So one of his ideas coming out of in a milieu where there had been a couple of other ideas that were challenging the major truths of the time, as I said, like Darwin's idea and some of the other ideas that were circulating at the time, but he was coming out very strongly saying, not only is Christian morality an untruth in its way, it is in our way. it is going to stop us as a species from becoming a better species. And that was sort of on his mind. Now, does anybody, any of you who've studied him clearly, why did he care about the species so much? That's one thing I haven't come across. Is there an idea someplace why he cared? Because he didn't care too much about the ordinary, way people thought about things. And so why the species that contained mostly people like that had to survive? I think mainly he was thinking, can we do better than this? And there are a couple of cute comments which show his Darwinian background where he says that, I want a race essentially as much different from humanity as humanity is from monkeys and chimpanzees. And basically that was his dream. And that's an idealistic dream. But idealistic dreams like that, if they're not patient enough, run off the rails. So he was very, very down on the philosophers that had that were so fond of thinking that they were just categorically right, being Kant. He just thought that this was foolish. But he had something to say about some of the more ancient ones, which I thought were really funny. On Epicurus, which is our subject next month, he said that he wrote 300 books, Epicurus did, wrote 300 books in a rage of ambition and anger against Plato. That he was trying to be better than Plato, essentially. He said it's very clear from the venomous joke that Epicurus wrote about Plato and his followers. He called them, and I'm sure I won't get the pronunciation of the Greek right because I don't know it, but Dionysius Colacus. Now, Plato went to try to teach Dionysius, the tyrant of Syracuse, and his son a little bit about how to become a philosopher prince, right? And word that he used, that Epicurus used, meant the baggage of a tyrant, the baggage of Dionysius. But it was also a term of derision against actors, apparently. And that term of derision against the actors meant that you're a dissembler, you're not really after the truth. And so Epicurus was sort of putting down Plato as not really being after the truth. Pretty hard argument to make, but that's why he made this point of view. I mean, why Nietzsche took this point of view on it, because he liked Plato. On the Stoics, he said, the Stoics say, the Stoics and the Epicureans are basically two lines that split off of Plato's school, for those of you. They're 100 years or so after were the leaders of both of those, and then they took off in different directions, very different directions, not unlike the nihilists and the existentialists and so on, which split off after Nietzsche. But on the Stoics, I thought he had a really great argument, Nietzsche did. He said, the Stoics want to live like nature. Live like nature. What does that mean? How does nature live? Nature is wasteful beyond measure. Nature is totally indifferent to what's going on. There doesn't seem to be any purpose to it. It's fertile and it's desolate at the same time. And he said, this is not living like nature. What they do is not living like nature. What Stoics do is a self-tyrannizing. You use your conscience to tyrannize yourself and keep yourself within a small thing. And then what they want to do is take nature and tyrannize that and put that into a small box too. Now it's interesting because in the Stoics, we're very, patient about the world. And patience about the world is probably extremely useful, especially in a disruptive society. But to say that they were living like nature, I think it was a very good observation on Nietzsche's part. It's totally untrue. Their ideal does not match what they're doing. What they're doing is something totally different. But at the end of the conclusion of that chapter, he says that philosophy is itself tyrannical. It's the tyrannical pursuit of, your own will to power. It's the spiritual will to power. And that tyrannical will to power is the strongest, aim of any enlightened being, including himself, I'm sure. So basically what he's saying is you take philosophy and you take your will to power, you try to recreate the world in the image, in the knowledge that you have, in the order that you have in your mind, and then you explain it to everybody else, hoping that they all then adopt your worldview, which is to impose your will about the whole world onto everyone else. So he considered that. But in recreating the world, one of the things that I thought was very interesting, what was his goal? Because I think it's always useful when you're analyzing somebody, his ideas and everything. What's the goal? What are the goals that he states? What is he after? And in this case, he's after life that's more vigorous and more cheerful. Those were his two words. More energetic, in other words, and more cheerful, both. And, you know, Socrates said something very, very similar. Socrates said he was really fond of the truth, but he was even more fond of ideas that made people more vigorous, more energetic, and happier, more especially cheerful, because cheerful is a special kind of happiness. Cheerful is a kind of confident happiness, which my analysis of cheerfulness is pretty simple. Happiness is itself, I take, is your emotion that you experience when you fulfill a desire. And cheerfulness is sort of a confidence that you know how to live life in a way which continually makes you happy, that makes you happy more often than not. And that cheerfulness is very attractive and is, you know, usurped in a false way by advertising all the time to sell all kinds of things, because that's what really, really attracts a lot of people who would like to have that cheerfulness, because essentially it means you're good at life. You're virtuous at life. You know how to, all kinds of things can knock you down. You can be sad about all the things that knock you down, but do you bounce back and become cheerful? Why do you do that? Because you know you have the capacity in yourself to make yourself happy by pursuing new desires, other things, going on, moving on. And the people who despair, being basically not the opposite, because it's, you know, there are no such things as opposites, as Nietzsche tried to point out, but it's a different emotion, and the despair is the lack of hope. Hope is your emotion that you can see the future holds happiness for you. Now, different idea structures, this is an aside, different idea structures have a big influence on how people in any culture experience hope, despair, so on, and the degrees of it. And I think if you take a look, for example, at homeless people on our streets. Basically, they're in despair that they can make a decision to do something about their lives. Something has knocked them down, or three or four things have knocked them down, and they don't feel that they can get over it. So what they basically want to do is escape to a certain extent. A lot of them are quite functional in lots of different ways, but basically there is I can't really get it together to even, you know, make housing and make a stable life for myself. But if you go to a place like India and see the despair on the streets in India, it's a totally different degree. That's what Nietzsche was very fond of saying. There's no opposites. There are degrees and subtleties, subtle differences and so on. There's a whole gradation, like of hot and cold. There's a whole gradation of hot and cold. In the case of our lives, it's not that simple. We don't just have one set of things. We have a whole multiplicity of desires. We have all our motives that influence our desires and color our desires. And those motives are the real desires. So that, as he said, that what we see is just the tip, just the skin on the outside. And what's that's our intention of what we're trying to intend. What's unintended is everything underneath it. And what that means, you know, in a psychological sense, and he thought psychology was the main science for humanity to study. What that means in a psychological sense is that our motives are our real desires. And most of the time you have conflicting motives when you're trying to accomplish something. A very simple version of this is, you know, if somebody's moving along, you know, they're 15 years into a relationship and they're thinking about getting divorced. And how are they thinking about the divorce? Well, you know, this has gone wrong, and so on and so forth, and I don't have so much hope for the future, the dream is gone, all that kind of thing. But, you know, sometimes it takes 10 years to come up with a decision to actually get the divorce, right? All of us have friends or our own experience along that line. Now, why is that? The reason why it takes so long is it's not a clear decision. It's not a clear-cut decision. You know, if it's six of one and half a dozen of the other, as the old saying goes, then it's not easy to make the decision. And it's not that satisfying after you've made the decision either, because now you're on the half six of a half a dozen and the six of one is on the other side. And so whenever it's a 51%, 49%, you know, and if it goes up to 60%, then you make the decision basically. But, you know, there's still 40% on the other side. So there's lots of regrets. There's lots of things that go wrong. And so these kind of decisions, difficult decisions, which school should I go to? You know, should it be Berkeley or Stanford? I know everybody in the crowd here will take sides on that one. But you know, which one should I go to? You know, for some people, it is the same, even a more cheerful version of a divorce, because both are going to work out. Both are most likely to work out. And you won't ever know when you make the decision whether the other one would have worked out better. The same is true about the people you pick in relationships, too. Something else might have worked out just fine. Even better, you don't know. But switching, you know, has a lot of costs. And that's why people don't switch so often. So in making these decisions, these are not easy decisions. And people say, I think in general, we should analyze and say, if it's not an easy decision to make, it's not as important as other decisions to make. Because it's not as important in terms of the effect on our happiness. Because we're going to mostly move from one side of the equation to the other side, and it's going to be pretty even. Whereas something that you're very, very keen on, you should spend more time on, because you're very keen on it, it's most likely going to be a big winner. And if you find out that it's not a winner, you're going to find out real quickly, most likely, and then you're going to drop it and move on to something else that you get really keen on. And so in analyzing the approach to desiring, that's something to keep in mind, because it doesn't look like that. It doesn't look like that when we have those difficult decisions to make. It's like that's the most important decision we have to make, but it actually isn't the most important for our happiness. If you have a different goal in mind, it is. But for our happiness, it's not. So that's one of my asides. One other thing on Plato, which I thought was very interesting about the 20th century. Of course, this was the 19th century this was written. And I think one of the things that shows that Nietzsche was a very good analyst of a lot of different things, not 100%, nobody has to be. With philosophers, especially with this many insights, it's a little like baseball. You know, if you bat 400, you know, you're a winner. If you lose 60% of the time, you strike out 60% of the time or make it out, you're still a superstar if you have bat 400. And Nietzsche certainly batted at least 400. But there, I wanted to close with two quotes, which I thought showed his insight into what was really going on. And this one is, again, about physics and Plato. He said, "It is perhaps just dawning on 5 or 6 minds." He wasn't really too optimistic about how many people were being observant. "That physics, too, is only an interpretation and an exegesis of the world, to suit us, if I may say so, and not a world explanation. But insofar it is based on a belief in the senses, it is regarded as more, and for a long time to come, must be regarded as more, namely as an explanation. Eyes and fingers speak in its favor. Visual evidence and palpableness do, too. This strikes an age with fundamentally plebeian tastes as fascinating, persuasive, and convincing. After all, it follows instinctively the canon of truth of eternally popular sensualism. What is clear, what is explained, only what can be seen and felt. Every problem has to be pursued to that point. Conversely," and by the way, I often lecture on science. The big mistake, I think, of the 20th century is that belief that we can't know anything we can't measure. It has gotten in the way of a lot of ideas. We have obviously been really good at it, learning a whole bunch of things, but it's gotten in the way of fundamental ideas in physics, no question about it. So, conversely, the charm of the Platonic way of thinking, which was a noble way of thinking, consisted precisely in resistance to obvious sense evidence. Perhaps among men who enjoyed even stronger and more demanding senses than our contemporaries." I won't go on, but all those asides, you know, like, well, the ancient Greeks were probably more robust and hardy people. That was a 19th century interesting idea. The British, there was the idea that you study the cranium and you figure out how smart people were, and people would go to the ancient Greek graveyards, and they would try to get skulls and stuff like that and see how big those skulls must have been for those people to have been so smart. When, you know, if you come down to it, most of the people were exactly like us, and there were about 100 people that weren't, and I'm sure you're not looking at their craniums, and, you know, there was nothing different about Einstein's cranium either. It has to do with something else, which, of course, is a Platonic answer to what everybody else would say is it has to be a physical thing. The physical differences are extremely minor, if any. So that I think, is certainly, you know, and his aside on this at the bottom was, "Where man cannot find anything to see or to grasp, he has no further business. That is certainly an imperative different from the Platonic one. But it may be just the right imperative for a tough, industrious race of machinists and bridge builders of the future who have nothing but rough work to do." So that's how he deals with the physics. Now, I did want to also read one more thing before I went up to discussion. And that was because of his identification with the Nazis later on, I wanted to say what he foresaw. And remember, this is written in 1885, 1886, something like that, Beyond Good and Evil. It's in that time. So it's well before any movement was well before World War One. It's during or right after the Prussian French wars and so on. But this is what he says about Europe. The strength to will and to will something for a long time is a little greater in Germany and more so in the German north than in the center of Germany, but much stronger yet in England, Spain, and Corsica. I guess he mentioned Corsica because of Napoleon. Here, in association with indolence, there with hard heads, not to speak of Italy, which is too young to know what it wants and still has to prove whether it is able to will. But it is strongest and most amazing by far in that enormous empire in between where Europe, as it were, flows back into Asia in Russia. There the strength to will has long been accumulated and stored up. There the will, uncertain whether as a will to negate or a will to affirm, is waiting menacingly to be discharged, to borrow a pet phrase of our physicists today. It may well take more than Indian wars and complications in Asia to rid Europe of its greatest danger. Internal upheavals will be needed too. The shattering of the empire into small units and above all the introduction of the parliamentary nonsense, including the obligation for everybody to read his newspaper with his breakfast. I do not say this because I want it to happen. The opposite would be rather more after my heart. I mean such an increase in the menace of Russia that Europe would have to resolve to become menacing too, namely to acquire one will by means of a new caste that would rule Europe, a long, terrible will of its own that would be able to cast its goals millennia hence. So the long, drawn-out comedy of its many splinter states, as well as its dynastic and democratic splinter wills, would come to an end. The time for petty politics is over. The very next century will bring the fight for the dominion of the earth, the compulsion to large-scale politics. That's awfully perceptive of what was about to happen, both about Russia. I mean, people don't think about it, but I mean, Russia, you know, shattered during World War One and was taken over by autocrats that, you know, was more, people would say, a will to negate, although the language was a will to affirm. And that reaction to Russia had to have played a part in the rise of Hitler in Germany, no question, if they didn't have that big thing. And so, you know, to see in advance where the politics are going 40, 50 years and say this next century is going to be like this, this is going to be, that takes great insight and definitely worth your time to look at other ones. And you can dismiss all kinds of things, but the man had insight. So thank you very much, and let's have some questions if there are any.
Since he negated Christianity, did he have any religion at all, or was he an atheist?
Well, he's often thought of as an atheist, but I don't think that. I think he, I know it's a little ironic, but I think of him as an idealist. His ideals centered around humanity, but he also, this idea of the Übermensch is the German word for it, overman or superman or something like that, it gives a wrong connotation, but basically he wanted people to be noble. I think his religion was nobility, noble virtue. It's a kind of a pagan idea, in a way. And he wanted man to achieve more. And, you know, he's not the only one. This is also a slight aside, but if you think about all the people in the world who traveled to see Florence, Rome, and the leftovers from all kinds of societies in the past, all the big, beautiful things, we hang on to every great piece of art. And you know, we tax people who aren't interested in that art in order to hang on to it. It costs a lot of money to hold it all together. And why does the ruling class, if that's what you want to call it, do that almost everywhere in the world? Now, lots of cultures have not done that. There are a lot of places where all the great stuff just deteriorated, and people from the outside came in and said, hey, how can you let that go? You know, we'll take it over. We'll take it. We'll restore it, and so on and so forth. And why is that? That is because those who hold that all together want to believe that man is noble enough to create all that art, all that architecture, all that beauty, and say, this is what man is. Man isn't, you know, the local strip mall. Man is this, the Colosseum. Regardless of the fact that what the Colosseum was used for was, you know, fights that we would not allow on TV today, in spite of the fact we have fairly low standards. So, you know, it's looking at the building, you look at the order and the organization of it. You know, some of that's it's very interesting. In ancient Greece, they had big theaters from before the time of Pythagoras, and it was just developing. They had some theaters, but Pythagoras got very excited about numbers, and harmony that's based upon mathematical relationships. And then suddenly the Greeks started building all of these mathematically related theaters. And boy, did they look different. They strike your eye immediately as something more beautiful. And there's a lot of psychologists who have done studies on why does humanity like symmetry, and symmetry in faces, symmetry in other things. But the ancient Greeks tapped into this with their fascination with numbers and their idea that the numbers were beautiful. And then they created things based on it. I mean, the Parthenon is still there. It's very fancily done with numbers. They went against the way you would normally do it because they used the mathematics to say it will look straight if we don't make it straight, but we actually make it at a slight angle. That kind of thing, and figure out the mathematics of that, of perspective. And so that mathematics was to create an illusion of mathematical perfection, which looks really wonderful to us. So it's a very fascinating approach to the way that we look at what we're doing and the fact that we hold on to everything. Because I can, you know, if every football stadium looked like the Colosseum, for example, you know, we wouldn't care if the Colosseum degenerated and fell apart. And if there were 1,000 people who painted like Michelangelo, or 1,000 people who painted like Da Vinci, we would let the old ones rot because they're in not that great a shape and it costs a lot of money to keep them up. But we want to believe that this is what our spirit is like. And you know why? Because some part of our spirit is like that. But it takes a vacation a lot.
Oh, okay. I think your presentation was really very good for a brief period of time, and I gather I walked in late taking over for someone else. Secondly, so that's a real compliment. Secondly, on Plato, it seems to me, and concentrate, no particular disagreement, but going maybe a little bit further, that Nietzsche's fondness and emulation of Plato in many ways is bifurcates when he sees Plato sticking to forms and Nietzsche sticking to human behavior and reality of science and Darwin, as you quite properly said. And then he sees Plato devolving through Socrates and Aristotle to, in effect, celebrate the redemption of the slave and turn the other cheek. And he wants to slap the cheek to wake people up. So he's anything that has a pathway toward Christianity, he departs from on those grounds. And for the most part, you could look at him as very anti-Aristotelian in almost every respect except perhaps mathematics. And I wonder if you'd comment in that area a little bit more. And is there good reading on that particular subject involving Nietzsche?
I can say right away, I don't know what the good reading on that subject is, so that I don't know. But I think that's right. He admired, I think, the nobility of Plato. What he was going for was sort of the nobility of the ideals of ancient Rome and ancient Greece, but in a philosopher. And the one that he got closest to was Plato. That you can read in his writing clearly that this is a man cut above, you know, from an emotional point of view, and that's what Nietzsche was after. But yes, he disagreed, and I think lots of people, think, you know, if only Plato hadn't written the thing against the poets in the Republic, you know, if only Plato hadn't written this one thing or that one thing. But, you know, what's interesting to me about that, is going back to the baseball analogy that I used before, is that Plato hit about 900, you know, and that's why, you know, he's not going anywhere fast. And I think his observation about Socrates, it's fairly interesting, you know. Even Plato kind of hints, let's slip a little bit of you know, not such perfect news about Socrates in one of his later dialogues, because he did distance himself. And a lot of people have a lot of research on, you know, what came from Plato and what came from Socrates. And clearly, Socrates was very good at logic and everything like that. But Plato actually, it's like having a really good logician teacher and a great man too. I'm not saying that, but I think Plato looked back to Pythagoras more and took off on that noble path in a way which Socrates really, you know, it's a very good first step. What it did was allow Plato to become somebody that Nietzsche could admire, because Plato didn't take himself as seriously as Pythagoras did. He was able to make jokes. Pythagoras did too, but he was able to make more jokes, undercut himself, not say, I am the truth the way and the life, or, you know, whatever, something like that. He gave all of his arguments. He broke the taboo against writing things down because he wanted everyone to know his arguments. I mean, Socrates, he records in his book Socrates saying, don't write anything down. It's very clear that he's going against what Socrates had said, or he wouldn't be writing it down. So, you know, that I think is one thing that Nietzsche admired. You know, he wanted somebody to step forward, make comments, but don't claim that this is it. This is, you know, we're a community, and let's get our ideas out there, and let's not be so afraid of all the other ideas that are out there. So that I think you're absolutely right. And I think I might be wrong on the numbers, but I think that he probably looked at Plato as you know, I might look at Plato as batting 900, and Nietzsche might say batted 800, but he certainly liked most of what he did. But I tend to agree with him that he was wrong about the forms. But, you know, I look at that and I say, Pythagoras, if you look at the history of it, Pythagoras, coming 150 or so years before that, came up with this idea that all is number. Well, now, anybody, when you get excited about a new idea, you usually carry it too far. And Pythagoras, you know, that was a brand new idea. He saw the relationship in music, which was numerical. He had the first proof of A squared plus B squared equals C squared. That was known before the triangular Pythagorean theorem. That was known, practically speaking, for building and so on. But he could see what the formula was. He could see what the relationship was and how to prove it. That's a really big step forward. And so you can look at Pythagoras and say, you know, people think he was a mystic and all that on top of it, but he basically was stepping forward with the idea of a concept. Now, we're all used to this idea now, but this was a new idea. This was a new way of trying to explain what's the relationship between things. We can put this in a way which not only in science, we can prove this so that it's always true, or at least always true as far as, you know, you can do. But in addition to that, you know, I think that Plato was the next step. He took this idea about number and said, well, everything isn't number. But he came up with the idea that everything is more beautiful. There's some form that we are following in this world, and we're imperfect copies of those perfect forms, and he was after this perfection. And the idea of perfection, the good, is what Nietzsche thinks was in the way, and I think he's right. I think he's right about that basic idea. But obviously, at the time of Plato, you're moving out of everybody thinking in terms of this perfection as the goal, and you are also working with this number idea, and I think he moved it closer to the idea of concept, Plato did, with his forms idea, but it was still too mystical for most people to get it. But I think all it is an early, fairly, somewhat mystical idea of our idea of concept. And then I think it's still an extremely useful idea because I think it did lead a lot of other thinkers to the idea of the concept. So that's how I look at it. So I agree with Nietzsche. I mean, now Nietzsche's right in the 19th century, and it's in the way. It's in the way if you believe in it. And he's right. You know, I mean, Aristotle got in the way of a lot of things. It's interesting that also, there's just another aside, but people complain about the Aristotelian, you know, Plato, they're fighting with each other, and, you know, there are the Aristotelians, and there's the Platonists and everything. And, you know, Plato and Aristotle were pretty good friends. You know, and if you were Plato, wouldn't you want a student as smart as Aristotle to be, you know, one of your students? And he stuck around for quite a while. And I'm sure that that was useful. And, in fact, I'm sure that Aristotle's, if you call plottingness and, you know, categorization and what would be called nerdiness today or something like that, was useful to bring Plato a little bit back down to earth, and that Plato's flights of fancy helped Aristotle move into bigger concepts than he might have otherwise done. So, you know, that kind of a relationship, if you any of you are professors, if you had a student like Aristotle walk in, you wouldn't care if you disagreed with him about half of what he had to say. You'd be very happy to have the other half. And you know, people like to have this total conflict between these guys, and it can't have been that way. Because they spoke nicely about each other most of the time.
George, I would like to ask about this, going back to the nobility of language, because you began this by saying that Nietzsche's philosophy was language affects grammar and then philosophy. And so I wanted to ask, could Wittgenstein have taken that into the next century, because wasn't that also his belief? Yeah. And could you, and the nobility, and where are we today with the nobility of language?
I think nobility is disappeared before the aristocracy did. And the aristocracy's not quite gone yet, but certainly on the way out. But, you know, the nobility of one language versus another is something he played with, and he said, well, you know, he mentioned a couple of other language groups that don't have a well-developed concept of I, the self, and so on and so forth. And, and therefore it would have been harder for them to develop the philosophy that was true in Sanskrit and ancient Greece and so on. I would defer to someone who studied Wittgenstein a little bit more to say, but he definitely is in the path that Nietzsche carried. Somebody, would either of you like to say anything? Anybody can? I've read Wittgenstein, but I felt in general that he went too far off on the language. You know, I mean, that's to me a 20th century idea, that language. I mean, language was so exciting. It's another example of what I said about all his number. You get so excited by having figured out something so fascinating, is that this is the pattern in all these languages, that, you know, you take it too far. And one of the things, I think, once people took it too far, then people reacted against it. And part of what they said, well, language really can't express a lot of things. Well, whether language can express a lot of things or not, it's all we have, really, to express it. And therefore, you know, we ought to be confident that it can do a fairly decent job. Now, even if we didn't have language, we can never put exactly our experience into anybody else's head. This is actually an argument I use about something more fundamental. You know, no one can ever know what it's like to be another person, right? No one can ever know what that's like, and therefore our language is incompetent to pass that on. But not only is our language incompetent, our faculties, our ability is incompetent, because everyone has this whole history behind them, and that whole history influences how they see things. Even so, we can convey to each other, because of concepts and because of other things, we can convey, based on common experiences, a very large amount of very useful information. You don't have to learn everything yourself by experience. You know, you don't have to go out there and figure out that the Earth is a sphere. You know, we have a lot of evidence. Now, most people, using their sense perception, this is the kind of thing that Nietzsche was saying, this is the limitation. In ancient Greece, you know, everybody was based on the sense perception. And they were saying the Earth is flat, that's what we see. But, you know, 99% of what you perceive with your senses tells you that. But there's a few anomalies. And if you want to explain those anomalies, you've got to piece everything back together into a new puzzle. And then you say, not only do I take care of the 99%, they make sense, but this other 1% fits right in. And that's how science, you know, moves forward. And that's done by the mind. That's done by analysis, by concepts, by you reorder and order the information that you bring in through your senses. Now, without the mind, nothing would be reordered. You know, the simple, even all your sense perception is still being experienced by your mind. So to go back to the idea about that, if you can't know what another person is like, you know, even a mind which is supposedly omniscient would not be able to know what it's like to be you. Not possible. Not possible. That's a limitation. Any limitation on knowledge means omniscience can't exist. And you can't know, for example, what it's like to be literate and to be illiterate at the same time. You were illiterate when you were young, now you're literate. You can remember what it's like to have been illiterate if you have a really good memory, but that's not the same as experiencing what it's like. And knowledge comes as an experience. It's an experience, and it's something that we use. And therefore, this belief, where does the belief come from? Because we think, finally, we would only make good decisions if only we were omniscient. I think that's very common, because we make a lot of mistakes. But as I say, it's a lot better to look at life a little bit more like a sport. And if you're batting 400 or 500, you know, you should be really patting yourself on the back about your life, you know. And so you really, really don't have to aim at perfection to say, it's worthwhile to keep feeding me. No, it's worthwhile to keep feeding almost everybody on the planet. There may be a few exceptions, but we won't name them.
Thanks. Really a separately oriented question from the previous ones. Your notion of cheerfulness, it strikes me as the kind that Camus writes about Sisyphus coming back down the hill, accepting fate. I always thought of that as a really enlightened form of inner self-confidence, not the braggadocio self-confidence, but one you really strove to achieve to yourself, to your essence. Do you think that's what Nietzsche was after?
Yes, I do. And unfortunately, you know, I think maybe due to health problems and other things, it was very difficult for him to get there, because, you know, you're still in the vehicle that you've got. But, yeah, I think I remember a person came up to me in one of these very aggressive, you know, I'd say overconfident people was really giving a friend of mine a hard time. And she said to me, I wish I was as confident as he is. And I said, he isn't as confident as you are. It is due to his lack of confidence that he behaves that way. You don't have to push on everybody else if you're confident. It's not confidence. It's the confidence of a con artist. Con artist comes from confidence. The confidence man. That's what it is. And it is. It comes. A line from Shakespeare says it the best. Methinks he protesteth too much. And he does. And he does because he lacked confidence. And this goes back to another main idea, which we can talk about because Nietzsche didn't think too much of this idea about God. But basically, you know, the description of God as needing our worship and needing our attention is a lot like, you know, I just saw the play Peter Pan. You know, when Tinkerbell is dying, you know, everybody has to clap in order to keep Tinkerbell alive. Well, we really, really, you know, if our God needs to be clapped for to keep him alive, it's not a very powerful character. And basically, you know, basically if you think about the personality, you can say really, really, the personality that he's given is what a tyrant king, a little petty king who's taken over a community, which was the common form of government 3,000 years ago and even 2,000 and even 1,000 years ago. And those people know that they don't really have the right to the power. They know that they've fooled the people in a way, even if they've been chosen because they're a good general or something like that. They know that they're not omniscient. They know that they're not omnipotent, but they want everybody to believe it, so they get as much as they can. And therefore, they have to use all kinds of tricks, and they have to show how powerful they are, and all those kind of things. It's not confined to the Bible. If you read the Bhagavad Gita on Krishna, you know, he has a nice long argument with Arjuna about, you know, how to become a better man and yoga and so on and so forth. And in the end, when Arjuna asks him another question after, you know, six or seven or, you know, about 12 chapters of it, he finally says, look, buddy, I am the earth, the moon, the universe. Here's what I am. And he shows him. He has a revelation so he can see the whole universe and the devouringness of everything. He's scared to death and he goes back and says, okay, I'll do whatever you say. And basically, that's the final argument in Job as well. You know, it really is, you know, comes down to it. That's what people with power in the end say when they don't have a good explanation. And if you think about it, if you really had omnipotence, you had all the power, nobody could take it away from you. You wouldn't be in any danger of anybody taking it away from you. You don't have to be insecure. You don't have to be tyrannical. You don't have, and not only that, but you knew what was going to happen in the first place. I mean, you made it up. So if that theory is true, I mean, this is where Nietzsche kept digging into things, you know, and says, this idea has to fall. This idea, if our race matures and becomes a more powerful race. And he was a little mad also that this idea had kind of overcome the pagan virtues of strength and virtue from another time. He thought it overcame. But, you know, if you look at history, I think something, if it hadn't been Christianity, it would have been something else that had brought it down. Because it's very short-lived, those times, what we call humanitarian, where human beings say, you know, I actually can accomplish something. I can get something done. You know, and if you look around and you see with everybody all striving to get things done, how hard it is to keep things organized and to have a good outcome over long periods of time, you can understand why it happens over and over again. So, ran a little bit over. Thank you very much. Thank you.